back around toward the right and then down into a screeching dive. Through endless blobs of ghostly black smoke he sped, the hanging smut wafting against the smooth plexiglass nose of the ship like an evil, damp, sooty vapor against his cheeks. His heart was hammering again in aching terror as he hurtled upward and downward through the blind gangs of flak charging murderously into the sky at him, then sagging inertly. Sweat gushed from his neck in torrents and poured down over his chest and waist with the feeling of warm slime. He was vaguely aware for an instant that the planes in his formation were no longer there, and then he was aware of only himself. His throat hurt like a raw slash from the strangling intensity with which he shrieked each command to McWatt. The engines rose to a deafening, agonized, ululating bellow each time McWatt changed direction. And far out in front, the bursts of flak were still swarming into the sky from new batteries of guns poking around for accurate altitude as they waited sadistically for him to fly into range. The plane was slammed again suddenly with another loud, jarring explosion that almost rocked it over on its back, and the nose filled immediately with sweet clouds of blue smoke. Something was on fire! Yossarian whirled to escape and smacked into Arfi, who had struck a match and was placidly lighting his pipe. Yossarian gaped at his grinning, moon-faced navigator in utter shock and confusion. It occurred to him that one of them was mad.
"Jesus Christ!" he screamed at Arfi in tortured amazement. "Get the hell out of the nose! Are you crazy? Get out!"
"What?" said Arfi.
"Get out!"
Yossarian yelled hysterically and began clubbing Arfi backhanded with both fists to drive him away.
"Get out! I still can't hear you!"
Arfi called back innocently with an expression of mild and reproving perplexity.
"You'll have to talk a little louder." "Get out of the nose!" Yossarian shrieked in frustration. "They're trying to kill us! Don't you understand? They're trying to kill us! Which way should I go, goddammit?"
McWatt shouted furiously over the intercom in a suffering, high-pitched voice.
"Which way should I go? Turn left! Left, you goddamn dirty son of a bitch! Turn left! Hard!"
Arfi crept up close behind Yossarian and jabbed him sharply in the ribs with the stem of his pipe. Yossarian flew up toward the ceiling with a whinnying cry, then jumped completely around on his knees, white as a sheet and quivering with rage. Arfi winked encouragingly and jerked his thumb back toward McWatt with a humorous moo.
"What's eating him?"
he asked with a laugh. Yossarian was struck with a weird sense of distortion.
"Will you get out of here?"
he yelped beseechingly and shoved Arfi over with all his strength.
"Are you deaf or something? Get back in the plane!"
And to McWatt he screamed,
"Dive! Dive!"
Down they sank once more into the crunching, thudding, voluminous barrage of bursting anti-aircraft shells, as Arfi came creeping back behind Yossarian and jabbed him sharply in the ribs again. Yossarian shied upward with another whinnying gasp.
"I still couldn't hear you,"
Arfi said.
"I said, get out of here!"
Yossarian shouted and broke into tears. He began punching Arfi in the body with both hands as hard as he could.
"Get away from me! Get away!"
Punching Arfi was like sinking his fists into a limp sack of inflated rubber. There was no resistance, no response at all from the soft, insensitive mass, and after a while Yossarian's spirit died, and his arms dropped helplessly with exhaustion. He was overcome with a humiliating feeling of impotence and was ready to weep in self-pity.
"What did you say?"
Arfi asked.
"Get away from me,"
Yossarian answered, pleading with him now.
"Go back in the plane. I still can't hear you." "Never mind,"
wailed Yossarian.
"Never mind. Just leave me alone." "Never mind what?"
Yossarian began hitting himself in the forehead. He seized Arfi by the shirt front and, struggling to his feet for traction, dragged him to the rear of the nose compartment and flung him down like a bloated and unwieldy bag in the entrance of the crawlway. A shell banged open with a stupendous clout right beside his ear as he was scrambling back toward the front, and some undestroyed recess of his intelligence wondered that it did not kill them all. They were climbing again. The engines were howling again as though in pain, and the air inside the plane was acrid with the smell of machinery and fetid with the stench of gasoline. The next thing he knew, it was snowing. Thousands of tiny bits of white paper were falling like snowflakes inside the plane, milling around his head so thickly that they clung to his eyelashes when he blinked in astonishment and fluttered against his nostrils and lips each time he inhaled. When he spun around in bewilderment, Arfi was grinning proudly from ear to ear like something inhuman as he held up a shattered paper map for Yossarian to see. A large chunk of flak had ripped up from the floor through Arfi's colossal jumble of maps and had ripped out through the ceiling inches away from their heads. Arfi's joy was sublime.
"Will you look at this?"
he murmured, waggling two of his stubby fingers playfully into Yossarian's face through the hole in one of his maps.
"Will you look at this?"
Yossarian was dumbfounded by his state of rapturous contentment. Arfi was like an eerie ogre in a dream, incapable of being bruised or evaded, and Yossarian dreaded him for a complex of reasons he was too petrified to untangle. Wind whistling up through the jagged gash in the floor kept the myriad bits of paper circulating like alabaster particles in a paperweight, and contributed to a sensation of lacquered, waterlogged unreality. Everything seemed strange, so tawdry and grotesque. His head was throbbing from a shrill clamor that drilled relentlessly into both ears. It was McWatt begging for directions in an incoherent frenzy. Yossarian continued staring in tormented fascination at Arfi's spherical countenance beaming at him so serenely and vacantly through the drifting whorls of white paper bits, and concluded that he was a raving lunatic, just as eight bursts of flak broke open successively at eye level off to the right. Then eight more, and then eight more. The last group pulled over toward the left so that they were almost directly in front.
"Turn left, hard!"
he hollered to McWatt as Arfi kept grinning, and McWatt did turn left hard, but the flak turned left hard with them, catching up fast. And Yossarian hollered,
"I said hard! 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 Hard, you bastard! Hard!"
And McWatt bent the plane around even harder still, and suddenly, miraculously, they were out of range. The flak ended. The guns stopped booming at them. And they were alive. Behind him, men were dying. Strung out for miles in a stricken, tortuous, squirming line, the other flights of planes were making the same hazardous journey over the target, threading their swift way through the swollen masses of new and old bursts of flak, like rats racing in a pack through their own droppings. One was on fire and flapped lamely off by itself, billowing gigantically like a monstrous blood-red star. As Yossarian watched, the burning plane floated over on its side and began spiraling down slowly in wide, tremulous, narrowing circles, its huge flaming burden blazing orange and flaring out in back like a long, swirling cape of fire and smoke. There were parachutes. One, two, three, four. And then the plane gyrated into a spin and fell the rest of the way to the ground, fluttering insensibly inside its vivid pyre like a shred of colored tissue paper. One whole flight of planes from another squadron had been blasted apart. Yossarian sighed barrenly, his day's work done. He was listless and sticky. The engines crooned mellifluously as McWatt throttled back to loiter and allow the rest of the planes in his flight to catch up. The abrupt stillness seemed alien and artificial, a little insidious. Yossarian unsnapped his flak suit and took off his helmet. He sighed again, restlessly, and closed his eyes and tried to relax. "Where's Orr?" someone asked suddenly over his intercom. Yossarian bounded up with a one-syllable cry that crackled with anxiety and provided the only rational explanation for the whole mysterious phenomenon of the flak at Bologna. "Orr!" He lunged forward over the bombsite to search downward through the plexiglass for some reassuring sign of Orr, who drew flak like a magnet, and who had undoubtedly attracted the crack batteries of the whole Hermann Goering division to Bologna overnight from wherever the hell they had been stationed the day before when Orr was still in Rome. Arfi launched himself forward an instant later and cracked Yossarian on the bridge of the nose with a sharp rim of his flak helmet. Yossarian cursed him as his eyes flooded with tears. "There he is," Arfi orated funereally, pointing down dramatically at a hay wagon and two horses standing before the barn of a gray stone farmhouse. "Smashed to bits. I guess their numbers were all up." Yossarian swore at Arfi again and continued searching intently, cold with a compassionate kind of fear now for the little bouncy and bizarre buck-toothed tentmate who had smashed Appleby's forehead open with a ping-pong racket and who was scaring the daylights out of Yossarian once again. At last, Yossarian spotted the two-engined, twin-ruddered plane as it flew out of the green background of the forests over a field of yellow farmland. One of the propellers was feathered and perfectly still, but the plane was maintaining altitude and holding a proper course. Yossarian muttered an unconscious prayer of thankfulness and then flared up at Orr savagely in a ranting fusion of resentment and relief.
"That bastard!" he began. "That goddamn stunted, red-faced, big-cheeked, curly-headed, buck-toothed, rat-bastard son of a bitch!"
"What?"
said Arfi.
"That dirty, goddamn, midget-assed, apple-cheeked, goggle-eyed, undersized, buck-toothed, grinning, crazy son of a bitch and bastard!"
Yossarian sputtered.
"What? Never mind. I still can't hear you,"
Arfi answered. Yossarian swung himself around methodically to face Arfi.
"You prick," he began. "Me? You pompous, rotund, neighborly, vacuous, complacent—"
Arfi was unperturbed. Calmly, he struck a wooden match and sucked noisily at his pipe, with an eloquent air of benign and magnanimous forgiveness. He smiled sociably and opened his mouth to speak. Yossarian put his hand over Arfi's mouth and pushed him away wearily. He shut his eyes and pretended to sleep all the way back to the field so that he would not have to listen to Arfi or see him. At the briefing room, Yossarian made his intelligence report to Captain Black and then waited in muttering suspense with all the others until Orr chugged into sight overhead finally with his one good engine still keeping him aloft, gamely. Nobody breathed. Orr's landing gear would not come down. Yossarian hung around only until Orr had crash-landed safely, and then stole the first jeep he could find with a key in the ignition and raced back to his tent to begin packing feverishly for the emergency rest leave he had decided to take in Rome, where he found Luciana and her invisible scar that same night. 16. Luciana. He found Luciana sitting alone at a table in the Allied officers' nightclub, where the drunken Anzac major who had brought her there had been stupid enough to desert her for the ribald company of some singing comrades at the bar.
"All right, I'll dance with you," she said before Yossarian could even speak. "But I won't let you sleep with me."
"Who asked you?"
Yossarian asked her.
"You don't want to sleep with me?"
she exclaimed with surprise.
I don't want to dance with you. She seized Yossarian's hand and pulled him out on the dance floor. She was a worse dancer than even he was, but she threw herself about to the synthetic jitterbug music with more uninhibited pleasure than he had ever observed, until he felt his legs falling asleep with boredom and yanked her off the dance floor toward the table at which the girl he should have been screwing was still sitting tipsily with one hand around Arfi's neck, her orange satin blouse still hanging open slovenly below her full white lacy brassiere, as she made dirty sex talk ostentatiously with Hoople Orr, Kid Samson, and Hungry Joe. Just as he reached them, Luciana gave him a forceful, unexpected shove that carried them both well beyond the table, so that they were still alone. She was a tall, earthy, exuberant girl with long hair and a pretty face, a buxom, delightful, flirtatious girl. "All right," she said. "I will let you buy me dinner, but I won't let you sleep with me." "Who asked you?" Yossarian asked with surprise. "You don't want to sleep with me. I don't want to buy you dinner." She pulled him out of the nightclub into the street and down a flight of steps into a black market restaurant filled with lively, chirping, attractive girls who all seemed to know each other, and with the self-conscious military officers from different countries who had come there with them. The food was elegant and expensive, and the aisles were overflowing with great streams of flushed and merry proprietors, all stout and balding. The bustling interior radiated with enormous engulfing waves of fun and warmth. Yossarian got a tremendous kick out of the rude gusto with which Luciana ignored him completely while she shoveled away her whole meal with both hands. She ate like a horse until the last plate was clean, and then she placed her silverware down with an air of conclusion and settled back lazily in her chair with a dreamy and congested look of sated gluttony. She drew a deep, smiling, contented breath and regarded him amorously with a melting gaze.
"Okay, Joe," she said,
her glowing dark eyes drowsy and grateful.
"Now I will let you sleep with me."
"My name is Yossarian."
"Okay, Yossarian,"
she answered with a soft, repentant laugh.
"Now I will let you sleep with me."
"Who asked you?" said Yossarian. Luciana was stunned.
"You don't want to sleep with me?"
Yossarian nodded emphatically, laughing, and shot his hand up under her dress. The girl came to life with a horrified start. She jerked her legs away from him instantly, whipping her bottom around. Blushing with alarm and embarrassment, she pushed her skirt back down with a number of prim, sidelong glances about the restaurant.
"Now I will let you sleep with me,"
she explained cautiously in a manner of apprehensive indulgence,
"but not now."
"I know, when we get back to my room." The girl shook her head, eyeing him mistrustfully and keeping her knees pressed together.
"No, now I must go home to my mama, because my mama does not like me to dance with the soldiers or let them take me to dinner, and she will be very angry with me if I do not come home now. But I will let you write down for me where you live, and tomorrow morning I will come to your room for Flicky Flick before I go to my work at the French office. Capiche?"
"Bullshit!" Yossarian exclaimed with angry disappointment. "Cosa vuol dire bullshit?" Luciana inquired with a blank look. Yossarian broke into loud laughter. He answered her finally in a tone of sympathetic good humor. "It means that I want to escort you now to wherever the hell I have to take you next, so that I can rush back to that nightclub before Arfi leaves with that wonderful tomato he's got without giving me a chance to ask about an aunt or friend she must have who's just like her.
Call me?"
"Subito, subito," he taunted her tenderly.
"Mama's waiting, remember?" "Si, si, mama."
Yossarian let the girl drag him through the lovely Roman spring night for almost a mile, until they reached a chaotic bus depot honking with horns, blazing with red and yellow lights, and echoing with the snarling vituperations of unshaven bus drivers, pouring loathsome hair-raising curses out at each other, at their passengers, and at the strolling, unconcerned knots of pedestrians clogging their paths, who ignored them until they were bumped by the buses and began shouting curses back. Luciana vanished aboard one of the diminutive green vehicles, and Yossarian hurried as fast as he could all the way back to the cabaret, and the bleary-eyed, bleached blonde in the open orange satin blouse. She seemed infatuated with Arfi, but he prayed intensely for her luscious aunt as he ran, or for a luscious girlfriend, sister, cousin, or mother who was just as libidinous and depraved. She would have been perfect for Yossarian. A debauched, coarse, vulgar, amoral, appetizing slattern whom he had longed for and idolized for months. She was a real find. She paid for her own drinks, and she had an automobile, an apartment, and a salmon-colored cameo ring that drove Hungry Joe clean out of his senses with its exquisitely carved figures of a naked boy and girl on a rock. Hungry Joe snorted and pranced and pawed at the floor in salivating lust and groveling need. But the girl would not sell him the ring, even though he offered her all the money in all their pockets and his complicated black camera thrown in. She was not interested in money or cameras. She was interested in fornication. She was gone when Yossarian got there. They were all gone. And he walked right out and moved in wistful dejection through the dark, emptying streets. Yossarian was not often lonely when he was by himself, but he was lonely now in his keen envy of Arfi, who he knew was in bed that very moment with the girl who was just right for Yossarian, and who could also make out any time he wanted to, if he ever wanted to, with either or both of the two slender, stunning aristocratic women who lived in the apartment upstairs and fructified Yossarian's sex fantasies whenever he had sex fantasies. The beautiful, rich, black-haired countess with the red, wet, nervous lips and her beautiful, rich, black-haired daughter-in-law. Yossarian was madly in love with all of them. As he made his way back to the officer's apartment, in love with Luciana, with the prurient, intoxicated girl in the unbuttoned satin blouse, and with the beautiful, rich countess and her beautiful, rich daughter-in-law, both of whom would never let him touch them, or even flirt with them. They doted kittenishly on Nately and deferred passively to Arfi, but they thought Yossarian was crazy, and recoiled from him with distasteful contempt each time he made an indecent proposal or tried to fondle them when they passed on the stairs. They were both superb creatures, with pulpy, bright, pointed tongues and mouths like round, warm plums, a little sweet and sticky, a little rotten. They had class. Yossarian was not sure what class was, but he knew that they had it, and he did not. And that they knew it, too. He could picture as he walked the kind of underclothing they wore against their svelte feminine parts, filmy, smooth, clinging garments of deepest black or of opalescent pastel radiance with flowering lace borders, fragrant with the tantalizing fumes of pampered flesh and scented bath salts rising in a germinating cloud from their blue-white breasts. He wished again that he was where Arfi was, making obscene, brutal, cheerful love with a juicy, drunken tart who didn't give a tinker's damn about him and would never think of him again. But Arfi was already back in the apartment when Yossarian arrived, and Yossarian gaped at him with that same sense of persecuted astonishment he had suffered that same morning over Bologna, at his malign and cabalistic and irremovable presence in the nose of the plane.
"What are you doing here?"
he asked.
"That's right! Ask him!" Hungry Joe exclaimed in a rage. "Make him tell you what he's doing here!"
With a long, theatrical moan, Kid Samson made a pistol of his thumb and forefinger and blew his own brains out. Hoople, chewing away on a bulging wad of bubble gum, drank everything in with a callow, vacant expression on his 15-year-old face. Arfie was tapping the bowl of his pipe against his palm leisurely as he paced back and forth in corpulent self-approval, obviously delighted by the stir he was causing.
"Didn't you go home with that girl?"
Yossarian demanded.
"Oh, sure, I went home with her," Arfie replied. "You didn't think I was going to let her try to find her way home alone, did you?
Wouldn't she let you stay with her?"
"Oh, she wanted me to stay with her, all right,"
Arfie chuckled.
"Don't you worry about good old Arfie. But I wasn't going to take advantage of a sweet kid like that just because she'd had a little too much to drink. What kind of a guy do you think I am?"
"Who said anything about taking advantage of her?"
Yossarian railed at him in amazement.
"All she wanted to do was get into bed with someone. That's the only thing she kept talking about all night long."
"That's because she was a little mixed up," Arfie explained. "But I gave her a little talking to and really put some sense into her."
"You bastard!"
Yossarian exclaimed, and sank down tiredly on the divan beside Kid Samson.
"Why the hell didn't you give her to one of us if you didn't want her?"
"You see?" Hungry Joe asked. "There's something wrong with him!"
Yossarian nodded and looked at Arfie curiously.
"Arfie, tell me something. Don't you ever screw any of them?"
Arfie chuckled again with conceited amusement.
"Oh, sure, I prod them. Don't you worry about me, but never any nice girls. I know what kind of girls to prod and what kind of girls not to prod. And I never prod any nice girls. This one was a sweet kid. You could see her family had money. Why, I even got her to throw that ring of hers away right out the car window."
Hungry Joe flew into the air with a screech of intolerable pain.
"You did what?"
he screamed.
"You did what?"
He began wailing away at Arfie's shoulders and arms with both fists, almost in tears.
"I'm gonna kill you for what you did, you lousy bastard! He's sinful, that's what he is! He's got a dirty mind, ain't he? Ain't he got a dirty mind?"
"The dirtiest," Yossarian agreed. "What are you fellas talking about?"
Arfie asked with genuine puzzlement, tucking his face away protectively inside the cushioning insulation of his oval shoulders.
"Oh, come on, Joe," he pleaded with a smile of mild discomfort. "Quit punching me, will you?"
But Hungry Joe would not quit punching until Yossarian picked him up and pushed him away toward his bedroom. Yossarian moved listlessly into his own room, undressed, and went to sleep. A second later, it was morning, and someone was shaking him.
"What are you waking me up for?"
he whimpered. It was Michaela, the skinny maid with the merry disposition and the homely, sallow face, and she was waking him up because he had a visitor waiting just outside the door. Luciana! He could hardly believe it. And she was alone in the room with him after Michaela had departed, lovely, hale, and statuesque, steaming and rippling with an irrepressible, affectionate vitality, even as she remained in one place and frowned at him irately. She stood like a youthful female colossus, with her magnificent columnar legs apart on high white shoes with wedged heels, wearing a pretty green dress and swinging a large, flat, white leather pocketbook, with which she cracked him hard across the face when he leaped out of bed to grab her. Yossarian staggered backward out of range in a daze, clutching his stinging cheek with bewilderment.
"Pig!"
she spat out at him viciously, her nostrils flaring in a look of savage disdain.
"Vive come un animale!"
With a fierce, guttural, scornful, disgusted oath, she strode across the room and threw open the three tall casement windows, letting inside an effulgent flood of sunlight and crisp, fresh air that washed through the stuffy room like an invigorating tonic. She placed her pocketbook on a chair and began tidying the room, picking his things up from the floor and off the tops of the furniture, throwing his socks, handkerchief, and underwear into an empty drawer of the dresser, and hanging his shirt and trousers up in the closet. Yossarian ran out of the bedroom into the bathroom and brushed his teeth. He washed his hands and face and combed his hair. When he ran back, the room was in order, and Luciana was almost undressed. Her expression was relaxed. She left her earrings on the dresser and padded barefoot to the bed, wearing just a pink rayon chemise that came down to her hips. She glanced about the room prudently to make certain there was nothing she had overlooked in the way of neatness, and then drew back the coverlet and stretched herself out luxuriously with an expression of feline expectation. She beckoned to him longingly with a husky laugh. "Now," she announced in a whisper, holding both arms out to him eagerly, "now I will let you sleep with me." She told him some lies about a single weekend in bed with a slaughtered fiancé in the Italian army, and they all turned out to be true, for she cried, "Finito!" almost as soon as he started, and wondered why he didn't stop until he had finitoed too and explained to her. He lit cigarettes for both of them. She was enchanted by the deep suntan covering his whole body. He wondered about the pink chemise that she would not remove. It was cut like a man's undershirt with narrow shoulder straps, and concealed the invisible scar on her back that she refused to let him see after he made her tell him it was there. She grew tense as fine steel when he traced the mutilated contours with his fingertip from a pit in her shoulder blade almost to the base of her spine. He winced at the many tortured nights she had spent in the hospital, drugged or in pain, with the ubiquitous, ineradicable odors of ether, fecal matter, and disinfectant, of human flesh mortified and decaying amid the white uniforms, the rubber-soled shoes, and the eerie nightlights glowing dimly until dawn in the corridors. She had been wounded in an air raid. "Dove?" he asked, and he held his breath in suspense.
"Napoli."
"Germans?"
"Americani."
His heart cracked, and he fell in love. He wondered if she would marry him.
"Tu sei pazzo,"
she told him with a pleasant laugh.
"Why am I crazy?" he asked.
"Perché non posso sposare."
"Why can't you get married?"
"Because I'm not a virgin," she answered.
"What has that got to do with it?"
"Who will marry me? No one wants a girl who is not a virgin."
"I will. I'll marry you."
"Ma non posso sposarti."
"Why can't you marry me?"
"Perché sei pazzo."
"Why am I crazy?"
"Perché vuoi sposarmi?"
Yossarian wrinkled his forehead with quizzical amusement.
"You won't marry me because I'm crazy, and you say I'm crazy because I want to marry you. Is that right?"
"Si."
"Tu sei pazzo," he told her loudly.
"Perché?"
she shouted back at him indignantly, her unavoidable round breasts rising and falling in a saucy huff beneath the pink chemise as she sat up in bed indignantly.
"Why am I crazy?" "Because you won't marry me."
"Stupido!"
she shouted back at him and smacked him loudly and flamboyantly on the chest with the back of her hand.
"Non posso sposarti, non capisci? Non posso sposarti!"
"Oh, sure, I understand. And why can't you marry me?"
"Perché sei pazzo."
"And why am I crazy?"
"Perché vuoi sposarmi?"
"Because I want to marry you.
Carina, ti amo,"
he explained, and he drew her gently back down to the pillow.
"Ti amo molto." "Tu sei pazzo,"
she murmured in reply, flattered.
"Perché?" "Because you say you love me. How can you love a girl who's not a virgin?"
because I can't marry you.
She bolted right up again in a threatening rage.
Why can't you marry me?
She demanded, ready to clout him again if he gave an uncomplimentary reply.
Just because I'm not a virgin?
No, no, darling. Because you're crazy.
She stared at him in blank resentment for a moment, and then tossed her head back and roared appreciatively with hearty laughter. She gazed at him with new approval when she stopped, the lush, responsive tissues of her dark face turning darker still, and blooming somnolently with a swelling and beautifying infusion of blood. Her eyes grew dim. He crushed out both their cigarettes, and they turned into each other wordlessly in an engrossing kiss, just as Hungry Joe came meandering into the room without knocking to ask if Yossarian wanted to go out with him to look for girls. Hungry Joe stopped on a dime when he saw them and shot out of the room. Yossarian shot out of bed even faster and began shouting at Luciana to get dressed. The girl was dumbfounded. He pulled her roughly out of bed by the arm and flung her away toward her clothing, then raced for the door in time to slam it shut as Hungry Joe was running back in with his camera. Hungry Joe had his leg wedged in the door and would not pull it out.
"Let me in!"
he begged urgently, wriggling and squirming maniacally.
"Let me in!"
He stopped struggling for a moment to gaze up into Yossarian's face through the crack in the door with what he must have supposed was a beguiling smile.
"Me no Hungry Joe," he explained earnestly. "Me heap big photographer from Life magazine. Heap big picture on heap big cover. I make you a big Hollywood star, Yossarian. Multi-dinero, multi-divorces, multi-ficky-fick all day long. See, see, see."
Yossarian slammed the door shut when Hungry Joe stepped back a bit to try to shoot a picture of Luciana dressing. Hungry Joe attacked the stout wooden barrier fanatically, fell back to reorganize his energies, and hurled himself forward fanatically again. Yossarian slithered into his own clothes between assaults. Luciana had her green and white summer dress on and was holding the skirt bunched up above her waist. A wave of misery broke over him as he saw her about to vanish inside her panties forever. He reached out to grasp her and drew her to him by the raised calf of her leg. She hopped forward and molded herself against him. Yossarian kissed her ears and her closed eyes romantically and rubbed the backs of her thighs. She began to hum sensually a moment before Hungry Joe hurled his frail body against the door in still one more desperate attack and almost knocked them both down. Yossarian pushed her away.
"Vit, vit!" he scolded her. "Get your things on!" "What the hell are you talking about?"
she wanted to know.
"Fast, fast! Can't you understand English? Get your clothes on, fast!" "Stupido!"
she snarled back at him.
"Vit is French, not Italian. Subito, subito, that's what you mean, subito! Si, si, that's what I mean, subito, subito!" "Si, si,"
she responded cooperatively and ran for her shoes and earrings. Hungry Joe had paused in his attack to shoot pictures through the closed door. Yossarian could hear the camera shutter clicking. When both he and Luciana were ready, Yossarian waited for Hungry Joe's next charge and yanked the door open on him unexpectedly. Hungry Joe spilled forward into the room like a floundering frog. Yossarian skipped nimbly around him, guiding Luciana along behind him through the apartment and out into the hallway. They bounced down the stairs with a great roistering clatter, laughing out loud breathlessly and knocking their hilarious heads together each time they paused to rest. Near the bottom, they met Nately coming up and stopped laughing. Nately was drawn, dirty, and unhappy. His tie was twisted and his shirt was rumpled, and he walked with his hands in his pockets. He wore a hangdog, hopeless look.
"What's the matter, kid?"
Yossarian inquired compassionately.
"I'm flat broke again,"
Nately replied with a lame and distracted smile.
"What am I going to do?"
Yossarian didn't know. Nately had spent the last 32 hours at $20 an hour with the apathetic whore he adored, and he had nothing left of his pay or of the lucrative allowance he received every month from his wealthy and generous father. That meant he could not spend time with her anymore. She would not allow him to walk beside her as she strolled the pavement soliciting other servicemen,
and she was infuriated when she spied him trailing her from a distance. He was free to hang around her apartment if he cared to, but there was no certainty that she would be there, and she would give him nothing unless he could pay. She found sex uninteresting. Nately wanted the assurance that she was not going to bed with anyone unsavory or with someone he knew. Captain Black always made it a point to buy her each time he came to Rome, just so he could torment Nately with the news that he had thrown his sweetheart another hump and watch Nately eat his liver as he related the atrocious indignities to which he had forced her to submit. Luciana was touched by Nately's forlorn air, but broke loudly into robust laughter again the moment she stepped outside into the sunny street with Yossarian and heard Hungry Joe beseeching them from the window to come back and take their clothes off, because he really was a photographer from Life magazine. Luciana fled mirthfully along the sidewalk in her high white wedgies, pulling Yossarian along in tow with the same lusty and ingenuous zeal she had displayed in the dance hall the night before and at every moment since. Yossarian caught up and walked with his arm around her waist until they came to the corner, and she stepped away from him. She straightened her hair in a mirror from her pocketbook and put lipstick on.
"Why don't you ask me to let you write my name and address on a piece of paper so that you will be able to find me again when you come to Rome?"
she suggested.
"Why don't you let me write your name and address down on a piece of paper?"
he agreed.
"Why?"
she demanded belligerently, her mouth curling suddenly into a vehement sneer and her eyes flashing with anger.
"So you can tear it up into little pieces as soon as I leave? Who's going to tear it up?"
Yossarian protested in confusion.
"What the hell are you talking about?"
"You will," she insisted. "You'll tear it up into little pieces the minute I'm gone and go walking away like a big shot because a tall, young, beautiful girl like me, Luciana, let you sleep with her and did not ask you for money."
"Well, how much money are you asking me for?" he asked her.
"Stupido!" she shouted with emotion. "I am not asking you for any money!"
She stamped her foot and raised her arm in a turbulent gesture that made Yossarian fear she was going to crack him in the face again with her great pocketbook. Instead, she scribbled her name and address on a slip of paper and thrust it at him.
"Here,"
she taunted him sardonically, biting on her lip to still a delicate tremor.
Don't forget to tear it into tiny pieces as soon as I am gone."
Then she smiled at him serenely, squeezed his hand, and with a whispered, regretful, "Addio," pressed herself against him for a moment and then straightened and walked away with unconscious dignity and grace. The minute she was gone, Yossarian tore the slip of paper up and walked away in the other direction, feeling very much like a big shot because a beautiful young girl like Luciana had slept with him and did not ask for money. He was pretty pleased with himself until he looked up in the dining room of the Red Cross building and found himself eating breakfast with dozens and dozens of other servicemen in all kinds of fantastic uniforms. And then, all at once, he was surrounded by images of Luciana getting out of her clothes and into her clothes and caressing and haranguing him tempestuously in the pink rayon chemise she wore in bed with him and would not take off. Yossarian choked on his toast and eggs at the enormity of his error in tearing her long, lithe, nude, young, vibrant limbs into tiny pieces of paper so impudently and dumping her down so smugly into the gutter from the curb. He missed her terribly already. There were so many strident, faceless people in uniform in the dining room with him. He felt an urgent desire to be alone with her again soon, and sprang up impetuously from his table and went running outside and back down the street toward the apartment in search of the tiny bits of paper in the gutter. But they had all been flushed away by a street cleaner's hose. He couldn't find her again in the Allied Officers' nightclub that evening, or in the sweltering, burnished, hedonistic bedlam of the Black Market restaurant, with its vast, bobbing wooden trays of elegant food and its chirping flock of bright and lovely girls. He couldn't even find the restaurant. When he went to bed alone, he dodged flak over Bologna again in a dream, with Arfie hanging over his shoulder abominably in the plane with a bloated, sordid leer. In the morning he ran looking for Luciana in all the French offices he could find, but nobody knew what he was talking about.
And then he ran in terror, so jumpy, distraught, and disorganized that he just had to keep running in terror somewhere, to the enlisted men's apartment for the squat maid in the lime-colored panties, whom he found dusting in Snowden's room on the fifth floor, in her drab brown sweater and heavy dark skirt. Snowden was still alive then, and Yossarian could tell it was Snowden's room from the name stenciled in white on the blue duffel bag he tripped over as he plunged through the doorway at her in a frenzy of creative desperation. The woman caught him by the wrists before he could fall as he came stumbling toward her in need, and pulled him along down on top of her as she flopped over backward onto the bed and enveloped him hospitably in her flaccid and consoling embrace, her dust mop aloft in her hand like a banner as her broad, brutish, congenial face gazed up at him fondly with a smile of unperjured friendship. There was a sharp, elastic snap as she rolled the lime-colored panties off beneath them both without disturbing him. He stuffed money into her hand when they were finished. She hugged him in gratitude. He hugged her. She hugged him back and then pulled him down on top of her on the bed again. He stuffed more money into her hand when they were finished this time and ran out of the room before she could begin hugging him in gratitude again. Back at his own apartment, he threw his things together as fast as he could, left for Nately what money he had, and ran back to Pianosa on a supply plane to apologize to Hungry Joe for shutting him out of the bedroom. The apology was unnecessary, for Hungry Joe was in high spirits when Yossarian found him. Hungry Joe was grinning from ear to ear, and Yossarian turned sick at the sight of him, for he understood instantly what the high spirits meant.
40 missions,
Hungry Joe announced readily in a voice lyrical with relief and elation.
The colonel raised him again.
Yossarian was stunned.
But I've got 32, goddammit, 3 more and I would have been through.
Hungry Joe shrugged indifferently.
The colonel wants 40 missions, he repeated.
Yossarian shoved him out of the way and ran right into the hospital. 17. The Soldier in White. Yossarian ran right into the hospital, determined to remain there forever rather than fly one mission more than the 32 missions he had. 10 days after he changed his mind and came out, the colonel raised the missions to 45, and Yossarian ran right back in, determined to remain in the hospital forever rather than fly one mission more than the 6 missions more he had just flown. Yossarian could run into the hospital whenever he wanted to because of his liver and because of his eyes. The doctors couldn't fix his liver condition and couldn't meet his eyes each time he told them he had a liver condition. He could enjoy himself in the hospital just as long as there was no one really very sick in the same ward. His system was sturdy enough to survive a case of someone else's malaria or influenza with scarcely any discomfort at all. He could come through other people's tonsillectomies without suffering any postoperative distress, and even endure their hernias and hemorrhoids with only mild nausea and revulsion. But that was just about as much as he could go through without getting sick. After that, he was ready to bolt. He could relax in the hospital, since no one there expected him to do anything. All he was expected to do in the hospital was die or get better, and since he was perfectly all right to begin with, getting better was easy. Being in the hospital was better than being over Bologna or flying over Avignon with Hoopel and Dobbs at the controls, and Snowden dying in back. There were usually not nearly as many sick people inside the hospital as Yossarian saw outside the hospital, and there were generally fewer people inside the hospital who were seriously sick. There was a much lower death rate inside the hospital than outside the hospital, and a much healthier death rate. Few people died unnecessarily. People knew a lot more about dying inside the hospital, and made a much neater, more orderly job of it. They couldn't dominate death inside the hospital, but they certainly made her behave. They had taught her manners. They couldn't keep death out, but while she was in, she had to act like a lady. People gave up the ghost with delicacy and taste inside the hospital. There was none of that crude, ugly ostentation about dying that was so common outside the hospital.
They did not blow up in midair like Kraft or the dead man in Yossarian's tent, or freeze to death in the blazing summertime, the way Snowden had frozen to death after spilling his secret to Yossarian in the back of the plane.
"I'm cold,"
Snowden had whimpered.
"I'm cold." "There, there,"
Yossarian had tried to comfort him.
"There, there."
They didn't take it on the lamb weirdly inside a cloud the way Clevenger had done. They didn't explode into blood and clotted matter. They didn't drown or get struck by lightning, mangled by machinery, or crushed in landslides. They didn't get shot to death in holdups, strangled to death in rapes, stabbed to death in saloons, bludgeoned to death with axes by parents or children, or die summarily by some other act of God. Nobody choked to death. People bled to death like gentlemen in an operating room, or expired without comment in an oxygen tent. There was none of that tricky now-you-see-me-now-you-don't business so much in vogue outside the hospital. None of that now-I-am-and-now-I-ain't. There were no famines or floods. Children didn't suffocate in cradles or iceboxes or fall under trucks. No one was beaten to death. People didn't stick their heads into ovens with the gas on, jump in front of subway trains, or come plummeting like dead weights out of hotel windows with a whoosh, accelerating at the rate of 32 feet per second to land with a hideous plop on the sidewalk, and die disgustingly there in public like an alpaca sack full of hairy strawberry ice cream, bleeding, pink toes awry. All things considered, Yossarian often preferred the hospital, even though it had its faults. The help tended to be officious, the rules, if heeded, restrictive, and the management meddlesome. Since sick people were apt to be present, he could not always depend on a lively young crowd in the same ward with him, and the entertainment was not always good. He was forced to admit that the hospitals had altered steadily for the worse as the war continued and one moved closer to the battlefront, the deterioration in the quality of the guests becoming most marked within the combat zone itself, where the effects of booming wartime conditions were apt to make themselves conspicuous immediately. The people got sicker and sicker the deeper he moved into combat, until finally in the hospital that last time there had been the soldier in white, who could not have been any sicker without being dead. And he soon was. The soldier in white was constructed entirely of gauze, plaster, and a thermometer, and the thermometer was merely an adornment left balanced in the empty dark hole in the bandages over his mouth early each morning and late each afternoon by Nurse Kramer and Nurse Duckett, right up to the afternoon Nurse Kramer read the thermometer and discovered he was dead. Now that Yossarian looked back, it seemed that Nurse Kramer, rather than the talkative Texan, had murdered the soldier in white. If she had not read the thermometer and reported what she had found, the soldier in white might still be lying there alive, exactly as he had been lying there all along, encased from head to toe in plaster and gauze, with both strange, rigid legs elevated from the hips and both strange arms strung up perpendicularly, all four bulky limbs in casts, all four strange, useless limbs hoisted up in the air by taut wire cables and fantastically long lead weights suspended darkly above him. Lying there that way might not have been much of a life, but it was all the life he had, and the decision to terminate it, Yossarian felt, should hardly have been Nurse Kramer's. The soldier in white was like an unrolled bandage with a hole in it, or like a broken block of stone in a harbor with a crooked zinc pipe jutting out. The other patients in the ward, all but the Texan, shrank from him with a tender-hearted aversion from the moment they set their eyes on him the morning after the night he had been sneaked in. They gathered soberly in the farthest recess of the ward and gossiped about him in malicious, offended undertones, rebelling against his presence as a ghastly imposition, and resenting him malevolently for the nauseating truth of which he was a bright reminder. They shared a common dread that he would begin moaning.
"I don't know what I'll do if he does begin moaning,"
the dashing young fighter pilot with a golden mustache had grieved forlornly.
"It means he'll moan during the night, too, because he won't be able to tell time."
No sound at all came from the soldier in white all the time he was there. The ragged round hole over his mouth was deep and jet black and showed no sign of lip, teeth, palate, or tongue. The only one who ever came close enough to look was the affable Texan, who came close enough several times a day to chat with him about more votes for the decent folk, opening each conversation with the same unvarying greeting.
"What do you say, fella? How you coming along?"
The rest of the men avoided them both in their regulation maroon corduroy bathrobes and unraveling flannel pajamas, wondering gloomily who the soldier in white was, why he was there, and what he was really like inside.
"He's all right, I tell you,"
the Texan would report back to them encouragingly after each of his social visits.
"Deep down inside, he's really a regular guy. He's just feeling a little shy and insecure now because he doesn't know anybody here and can't talk. Why don't you all just step right up to him and introduce yourselves? He won't hurt you."
"What the goddamn hell are you talking about?" Dunbar demanded. "Does he even know what you're talking about?"
"Sure he knows what I'm talking about. He's not stupid.
There ain't nothing wrong with him. Can he hear you?"
"Well, I don't know if he can hear me or not, but I'm sure he knows what I'm talking about.
Does that hole over his mouth ever move?"
"Now, what kind of crazy question is that?"
the Texan asked uneasily.
"How can you tell if he's breathing if it never moves?"
"How can you tell it's a he?
Does he have pads over his eyes underneath that bandage over his face?
Does he ever wiggle his toes or move the tips of his fingers?"
The Texan backed away in mounting confusion.
"Now what kind of crazy question is that? You fellas must all be crazy or something. Why don't you just walk right up to him and get acquainted? He's a real nice guy, I tell you."
The soldier in white was more like a stuffed and sterilized mummy than a real nice guy. Nurse Duckett and Nurse Kramer kept him spick and span. They brushed his bandages often with a whisk broom and scrubbed the plaster casts on his arms, legs, shoulders, chest, and pelvis with soapy water. Working with a round tin of metal polish, they waxed a dim gloss on the dull zinc pipe rising from the cement on his groin. With damp dish towels, they wiped the dust several times a day from the slim black rubber tubes leading in and out of him to the two large stoppered jars, one of them hanging on a post beside his bed, dripping fluid into his arm constantly through a slit in the bandages, while the other, almost out of sight on the floor, drained the fluid away through the zinc pipe rising from his groin. Both young nurses polished the glass jars unceasingly. They were proud of their housework. The more solicitous of the two was Nurse Kramer, a shapely, pretty, sexless girl with a wholesome, unattractive face. Nurse Kramer had a cute nose and a radiant, blooming complexion dotted with fetching sprays of adorable freckles that Yossarian detested. She was touched very deeply by the soldier in white. Her virtuous, pale-blue, saucer-like eyes flooded with leviathan tears on unexpected occasions and made Yossarian mad.
"How the hell do you even know he's in there?" he asked her.
"Don't you dare talk to me that way," she replied indignantly.
"Well, how do you? You don't even know if it's really him."
"Who?"
"Whoever's supposed to be in all those bandages. You might really be weeping for somebody else. How do you know he was even alive?"
"What a terrible thing to say," Nurse Kramer exclaimed. "Now you get right into bed and stop making jokes about him."
"I'm not making jokes. Anybody might be in there. For all we know, it might even be Mud."
"What are you talking about?"
Nurse Kramer pleaded with him in a quavering voice.
"Maybe that's where the dead man is."
"What dead man?"
"I've got a dead man in my tent that nobody can throw out. His name is Mud."
Nurse Kramer's face blanched, and she turned to Dunbar desperately for aid.
"Make him stop saying things like that," she begged.
"Maybe there's no one inside," Dunbar suggested helpfully.
"Maybe they just sent the bandages here for a joke."
She stepped away from Dunbar in alarm.
"You're crazy,"
she cried, glancing about imploringly.
"You're both crazy."
Nurse Duckett showed up then and chased them all back to their own beds while Nurse Kramer changed the stoppered jars for the soldier in white. Changing the jars for the soldier in white was no trouble at all. since the same clear fluid was dripped back inside him over and over again with no apparent loss. When the jar feeding the inside of his elbow was just about empty, the jar on the floor was just about full, and the two were simply uncoupled from their respective hoses and reversed quickly so that the liquid could be dripped right back into him. Changing the jars was no trouble to anyone but the men who watched them changed every